I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 15 of Season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off this week is David Brook of Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show, David.
Hello. Glad to be back. Final episode for me. Plenty more for you.
That's fine. I'm not complaining about that. So episode 15 begins with Bert looking over at George and ends with Harry showing how much of a teenager he really is. So we ended things yesterday with Violet walking away and getting stared at by an unknown man. And then this minute begins with both Bert and George continuing to stare in her direction. Which is something that I don't know if they would do that nowadays in movies.
No, yeah, I was thinking.
Yeah. But it works, you know, it works here for what it's worth. You know, by the way that they do this.
Yeah, I think it works. They're leering a bit, but it's not too like
right.
Yeah. They get away with it. I like it.
And then Ernie sort of interrupts them and goes, "How would you like to take yes?"
There's a lot of innuendo between these next
couple
of lines.
There's a lot of innuendo here, and then and basically Ernie interrupts them, you know, with their staring, and then George says, "Want to come along, Bert? We'll show you the town." And Bert looks at his watch and goes, "No thanks. I think I'll go home and see what the wife's doing." So this is clearly innuendo here.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, Bert staring at Violet caused some sort of stirring by him that he has therefore decided that he's going to go home. For lack of a better term, it sounds like he's looking for a nooner at this point. I mean, I don't know what that says about him, that this is what causes him to want to go home and see his wife. I guess you can say that you can look on the bright side that he's not straying from his wife, at least.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it could be seen in a positive one, yeah.
There are ways to positively spin it. Yeah. You know, the idea is that, you know, if you want to be with your loved one, you want to be with them because of them, not because something else has, you know, caused you to be reminded that you love someone else.
I think the next line that caps off this little scene kind of makes sure that it's right. More in the other direction there.
That's right. And then Ernie looks at him and goes, "Oh, family man." Yeah, that's but again, it's funny that Ernie would say that, because you know, if these are all so, if the three of them are such good friends, you know, wouldn't Ernie already know if he is a family man?
Well, I think it's clearly a bit of an ironic kind of comment, I think.
Right. But whatever. For me, it's always funny. And I mentioned this on I think, earlier seasons, you know, at some point, that I always had the impression that older movies were more pure. Mm. But, you know, as I got older and started watching more older movies, you can hear the innuendo and you can hear things that they allude to. Mm. You know, that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah. And then there's there's pre-code stuff where they actually were a little more open, still not as much as they are now, perhaps, but pre-code things were pretty risky. And then, but then what happened kind of post-code when they brought the production code in, they had to do things through innuendo and kind of suggestion, and they kind of turned it into an art.
because they had to still get past the censors. They had to do it in a way that the censors wouldn't get it. You know? But I mean, looking at what Bert says here is just, it seems so blatant. I don't know why. I don't know what was wrong with the censor that he wasn't able to catch this type of thing. Again, I think it's funny, and I think it works within the movie. It's fine.
Yeah. I imagine the censors would get it, but I think they allow it as long as it's not blatant. I don't know. I guess the excuse is, I guess it's like I had this situation recently, because the Barbie movie was out, and my kids got invited to it, a friend of theirs, but the film in the UK is a 12A, which means anyone under 12 needs to go with an adult.
Okay.
And usually my kids like 7 and 9. We wouldn't usually take them to a 12. We think, oh, it's a bit too old for them. But we kind of thought, well, Barbie, why is it 12? So we actually did some digging, and in the description on the BBFC, it was kind of saying it was really kind of a 12 because of a lot of innuendo, and there's some other bits in there I think that make it 12. There's like a bit of a face slap and stuff. But what we figured is, well, the kids won't get the innuendos, so what's the harm? And I guess that might be where that could be the argument you're saying with the censors, is that if kids end up watching these films at the cinema, they're not really going to understand the innuendos, so we let them slide.
The idea of censors back then was not for kids, it was for adults.
I don't think they had the rating system though. I think it probably was for kids. I think it's they didn't want these things on screen because the kids would just show up to anything.
It wasn't but just kids; know. It was for anybody. They were looking at it from Christian values and things like that. These are not things that people should be watching. That type of thing.
I guess that's what it is.
I mean, again, if you listen to all of the stories of actors in the 20s and 30s. You know, about all the sex parties and orgies and, you know, it's amazing how they had to cap everything that was on screen. And these people just completely let it loose, you know, off screen.
Yeah.
You know, was it what's his name? Artie Barbuckle or something like that? There was Fatty Arbuckle.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Where there was a murder and it was, I mean, the whole thing was just it's always fascinating to think about this because, again, it goes back to the way that my brain was, you know, when I was younger, that movies back then were pure. You know, it's like the idea that people won't think of their parents and grandparents and great grandparents in uncompromising positions and things like that. But the idea is that society hasn't changed. You know, the way that children are born hasn't changed in thousands of years. So no. You know, it doesn't matter how far back you go, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
there's nothing new under the sun, I guess you could say.
That's why censorship is pure nonsense.
Correct. Exactly. But again, if you look at it from perspective that you were mentioning before, that maybe it's censorship for children, so I can sort of understand it. But again, you know, the amount of things that children are exposed to these days is, everywhere. It's not just in movies. You know, you now have them in video games, and video games where you have to kill the pimps. And you have
Grand Theft Auto and stuff like that.
Right.
It's crazy.
You know, that's the way Grand Theft Auto is, you know, that type of thing. So, I don't know. I'm not 100% sure if Bert is saying this as, if Ernie is saying it as a joke to Bert or not, when he says to him, family man. You know, maybe his comment is basically saying, oh, this is a guy who wants a bigger family. I don't know. It's possible. It's possible. You know, and back to what we were saying before about the censors, maybe the censors heard this, but they said, okay, but he's going to be, he wants to go home and do something pure with his wife, as opposed to cheating on her and anything like that. I mean, again, this movie is a prime example of of something that people still wonder how it got through the code. One of the things in the code is that people must be punished for their deeds. Mm. Okay, and Potter gets away with what he's doing here. You know, he's never caught. Nobody even finds out that it is Potter. We're the only ones who know that Potter has the money, and we also know how he got it. It wasn't he didn't steal it. He just didn't return it. That's what it comes down to.
Although I guess he loses in the way that he doesn't get the building alone that he's constantly after. I guess you could argue that.
Correct, but he doesn't like go to jail for stealing.
But no, like that, he doesn't. You know? Yeah, there's no repercussions. No.
That's right. In most movies in the code era, you know, you have to actually have some sort of repercussion.
Yeah,
you
know, whether even if it's a good guy. Yeah,
that's right. That even if you have to go to jail or you get killed or whatever it is for the crime that you committed or something like that. So, yeah, I don't know. And you know, you know, they give us the impression that we're going to get a cruise of Bedford Falls, but we don't. You know, as Bert walks away and Ernie looks at him, you know, the we get another screen wipe, which these screen wipes actually also remind me of Star Wars.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's loads in there. Yeah,
you know, the Star Wars does it the same type of way. Also, obviously, it looks very different when it's in black and white as opposed to in color. But still. And then we see Peter Bailey sitting at a table, and we see Ma Bailey standing on the other side of the table. And then you hear her scream, "George, Harry, you're shaking the house down. Stop it! Oh, let them alone. This is Peter. I wish I was up there with them. But Harry will tear his dinner suit, George. And then Annie, the housekeeper, comes in and goes, "That's why all children should be girls." And then Ma Bailey looks at her and goes, "Well, if they were all girls, there wouldn't be any..." Oh, never mind.
Some more risky comments. I must say, is the comment about all children should be girls is nonsense as well, being a father of two girls. That's just bad.
Yes, and yours, as you mentioned, are 7 and 9. So yeah. they haven't even reached their peak yet. That's okay. My daughters are 9 and 12. So, and they haven't reached their peak yet either. You know, my 16 year old son, my 18 year old son, and my 19 year old son, they have. a little familiar, and people warn us that teenage girls are possibly worse. So who knows?
So I've heard. I've been.
We shall have to wait and see. That's right. And I love the way that you know, they don't have to show us that George and Harry are dancing upstairs. We see the chandelier dancing.
Yeah, it's nice. Nice touch.
Exactly. And then Annie picks up the broom and starts pounding on the ceiling. And then we hear, "George, Harry, come down to dinner this minute. Everything's getting cold. And you know how long we've been waiting for you." So, you know, it looks like Peter started eating already. Mm. You know, he's comfortable at the table.
Take it in.
Yeah. Because, hey, if the food's still warm, why not? You know, why would you wait? And then we finally see Jordan and Harry come down from upstairs. And, I mean, the rest of the scene says so much about the family dynamics and the atmosphere in that house and things like that. You know, that Ma Bailey is more of a disciplinarian and Peter Bailey still is young at heart. You know, he's still, you know, he says, "I wish I could be there. I wish I could go and jump around with them."
Although he's kind of although he's saying that, he's suggesting it's past him, but it's still in his mind because he always has quite a calm demeanor though.
That's right. I think the idea is that I could, but I don't need to.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what it comes down to. So I'm not really sure about that. And then George and Harry show up and they both say, "Okay, Ma." And then they start singing and they go, "Ta-da." And then we get a dog barking. And then they walk over to Peter and they go, "We got a present for you, Pop. And I mean, again, it shows the great dynamic of this family. Then again, what does it say about the fact that they have this live-in housekeeper? You know, do you think? I mean, we know that the Baileys are not a rich family like Powder or something like that, but they still can afford to have a whether it's a live-in maid or just a maid, it doesn't matter. But this is someone who's part of the family, meaning she's been there a while. She didn't just show up yesterday.
No. So they've definitely got something. I guess, I mean, if you own a building alone, I guess even if it's not a super successful one, you must have something. And
maybe Peter Bailey is skimming off the top.
Maybe. He's quite well dressed gentleman, I guess. But
that's true also. Well, he's a businessman.
At least he is. Yeah.
You know, that he can't get away with. Yeah.
No.
And we actually do see him take the food. He opens the lid and like spoons out soup or something like that. And it's done very well. You know, and again, for those not watching it as we're talking, the present that they give Peter is actually his wife, who they've now carried over. You know, they carry over Ma Bailey to them. And she starts laughing, and then she goes, "Oh, you two idiots." And she goes, "George, sit down and have dinner." And then George says, "Fine." And Harry goes, "I've already eaten." And then she looks at him and goes, "Well, aren't you going to finish dressing for that graduation party? Look at you." He says, "I don't care. It's George's." And again, George's tux. It gets cut off there. So, I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of this minute, you know, that the minute ends with Harry showing he's a teenager. Basically, he's saying, "This isn't mine. I don't care." Which is a very teenage thing to say.
Yeah. The very last shot, just freeze framing right at the last shot, just right at the end, literally last moment, is odd because it's actually cutting off Harry's head, the lampshade.
That's
right. I guess they've kept the lampshade prominent so they could have the gag with it bouncing around, but they never moved the camera down enough to see everybody. I guess they'd never. It'd be difficult to move it down far enough.
So we should start calling Harry Lampshade Harry.
Yeah, I think so. It's just the absolute moment I've frozen it is right in the middle of the lampshade. It does look like it's on his head.
Yeah, I see exactly what you're talking about. Okay. I see that too, the same way. And I mean, it's also very funny his comment that he says this is George's, but the two of them are nowhere close to being the same height.
Yeah, it never fit him. And looking at the arms, they're actually kind of a little short, or perfectly
correct. Fit. And forget about that. Aren't we going to find out like next week that George has another tux, I guess?
Oh, yeah, true. Who has two tuxes?
Well, when Pa Bailey is skimming off the top, then maybe,
yeah.
Maybe they're able to afford
two, where you find out the truth.
That's right. So do you know like different names for tuxedos?
Oh, I'm trying to think, like a penguin suit or something. I don't know. Sometimes people call it. I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Right. So
people call it penguin references at least.
Right. So a tuxedo is either a dinner suit or a dinner jacket. Black tie attire.
Yeah.
It's actually do you know that the British term for black tie attire?
I'm British. I should do. I'm
probably not going to be able to pronounce it right. Synecdoche.
Oh, really? I've not heard that one.
It's.
I obviously don't go enough to go. Don't go to enough black tie do's.
Apparently not. It's synecdochically. Interesting. Now, I've never heard that either beforehand. When do you think the first tuxedo was unveiled, revealed?
The first tuxedo. Probably in. I'm trying to think if they wore it back in the 1790s or something. No.
1865 in England, the Prince of Wales, who later became King Edward VII. Was the first person to to wear a lounge jacket that basically can be called the first tuxedo, the way that it was created. And the idea of a dinner jacket is sometimes it's called a smoking jacket because of the fact that it, you know, people would smoke while wearing this jacket, you know, in formal situations and formal attire and things like that.
I always thought the smoking jacket. I always thought the smoking jacket was something a bit different that you wore later in the night, but no, maybe not.
Right. And then the idea of the name Tuxedo came from there was a village in New York State called Tuxedo Park, where they actually introduced this type of attire in 1886. You know, the counterculture of the 60s has changed black tie to white tie, you know, where you have a mix and match of colors and things like that, which has changed. You know, it's not formally that both the tie and the suit itself are black. Mm. So, yeah, no, it's interesting the way that that these things evolve.
I'm just looking on Wikipedia now. There's one picture saying American tuxedo dinner jacket, sometimes called the dress sack. Dress sack doesn't quite have the same kind of luxurious ring to it.
No. No. I actually saw that picture too. Right. But again, you know, I think that the family dynamics here is shown really well. You know, it goes back to what we were saying about the fact that Capra is a visual director. So there's a lot of things that he can show about the connections between George and Harry and George and Ma Bailey and Harry and Ma Bailey and Ma Bailey and Peter Bailey and, you know, Annie and everyone. You know, like you can go through all the different characters here and talk about the various connections between them just by the way that they're all portrayed in this scene.
Yeah. I think something that you definitely get here, and I've not really mentioned in the other scenes, because I think it happens quite a lot in the film and in a lot of Capra's films. He has quite busy frames, like there's quite a lot going on. I guess we've mentioned a lot of the little things we've noticed in there, but again, this links in with his visual storytelling, his kind of silent era's education. It's saying a lot with each visual, and there's not a huge amount of cutting. Like there's quite often he'll have a lot of stuff going on in the wide and just cut occasionally when needed.
Right.
Which I always like that kind of approach.
Yeah. That's true. And that's how this minute ends, and that's how this week will end. So, David, did you have anything else you want to say about this week? Oh, sorry, about this week, about the movie, anything in general?
Oh, not really. As I say, it's another light little... All these early scenes we've been covering this week, I guess, have been the light character building kind of fun side of the film before it starts to gradually get darker. Although there's always light moments in there, keeping you on your toes. It's I do think it's kind of a beautifully paced and a beautifully kind of I don't know the word for it really is the kind of balance of emotion of drama in the film is so kind of deftly handled. It jumps around a bit, you could say, but it does it so smoothly and so naturally. It's just always a pleasure to watch, and it's quite a long film, and but it's never boring. Like I would never be like, oh, I can't be bothered to sit through that again. It's just, yeah, I'm always pleased to stick it on. Usually only at Christmas. It did feel weird watching it in when we recorded this. I don't know. Ruin the illusion of the listeners, but it certainly wasn't around Christmas.
saying you can only watch this around Christmas time?
I usually only watch it around Christmas time. Yeah, I usually do. But to be honest, it's only really the kind of the end bit that's at Christmas. So there's no reason why not. But it did feel weird. In fact, it was kept in a. We've got like a Christmas box with Christmas stuff, and the Blu-ray that I went to watch was actually in the Christmas box. So that is how Christmassy this film usually feels to me. But watching it now, actually, as I say, I'll give the game away. It was in summer. It didn't feel wrong at all, and I still loved it. I didn't need to be in that Christmassy mood. Okay. It's just a wonderful film.
It's a wonderful film. Yes. What's your history with it? Like, do you remember when you first saw it?
It will have been back in my early kind of when I first started my lifelong obsession with collecting physical media. Is I got it on video, VHS. I think that will have probably been the first time I saw it. I got it on VHS. I can remember it had a really nice kind of, because in the UK, a lot of the videos will get in plastic boxes. Mm-hmm. In the US, I think a lot, they tend to use those cardboard cartons more often. But we used to get the plastic box ones. But this one wasn't a plastic box. It was a cardboard one, but like thick cardboard. It was all white to give it that snowy, Christmassy kind of look. And I always really liked the box. I would have got it on via video when I was first kind of collecting videos. So it would have been, I'd have probably been about 15 or something, maybe. Mm-hmm. So back in the 90s. And I loved it straight away. I was only just getting into properly into older movies back then, so it's probably one of the first kind of, not certainly not the first, but one of the early kind of black and white movies that I watched, and as I say, fell in love with it and watched it every few years since, really. And I got to screen it. I've got to see it on the big screen a couple of years ago, when, because I used to run a touring cinema service that went into village halls around Lincolnshire and show movies. We used to generally show new movies, but now and again we put old classics on, and every Christmas in the village halls we'd put on a Christmas movie, and this was one of them. So I got to show it to an appreciative audience on our kind of pop-up projector screen. Which is really nice. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's very cool. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of movies I'd love to still see in the theater at some point. Yeah. This is up there. I still would love to see Die Hard in the theater. I've never seen that one.
Oh, yeah, that would be cool.
I'd love to see Saving Private Ryan again in the theater. I saw it twice when it came out. But that's a movie that I would love to see again in the theater.
Yeah, that's an amazing cinema experience.
Definitely. Yeah.
Sure. I must admit I've got a projector at home, and it's not quite the same as the cinema, but it's pretty darn close. And ever since getting a projector, I cannot go back to TV. I hate watching films on TV. if I'm ever somewhere when we've only got a TV, if I'm staying at someone's house or we're away or something, and there's a good film on that I've got on Blu-ray at home, I'm like, no, I don't want to watch it on TV. I want to watch it at home on the Blu-ray, big, blown up, proper sound. I'm like, I'm really spoiled with it now.
Oh, wow. No, that's very, very. I hope I never reach that point. You know, I watch movies everywhere. I'll watch it on my phone. You know, it's like, it's,
oh no, never. And I do watch special features on my phone all the time, but when it comes to the movies, right. I do it properly now. I'm too spoiled with it now.
Right. Okay. Great. The Friday segment this season, we're doing something a little different. I mean, this is a movie that was nominated among the Best Picture nominees of 1946. It did not win Best Picture. That was won by The Best Years of Our Lives. So it always gets me wondering, you know, what people think about, you know, the Oscars, you know, and like, which movies do they believe that the Oscars made a mistake and should have given, you know, the Best Picture award to something else. The only caveat here is it needs to be something that was actually nominated. You know, you can't say, oh, this is, I love Memento, and therefore Memento should have won that year. I mean, it wasn't nominated, so that doesn't count. It can only be something that was nominated in a given year. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up to which movies you believe they really messed up with at the Oscars.
Yeah, this is a tricky one. There are a lot I could choose from, and it was difficult to pick my favorites. I've kind of gone with the first couple of films where the film that won is a decent film, but the ones that could have won are just my personal favorites. So I've gone with those for the first couple, and that's so yeah. Number five is in 2000. Gladiator won Best Film, But Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is the film I would have gone with there. I have always felt Gladiator, it's a fun movie. I quite like it, but I always felt it was a bit overrated. Like, people went crazy about it at the time. But for me, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I adore that film. I just think it's a much more graceful, much more beautiful kind of film than Gladiator. I just think it's a much stronger film that should definitely have won. Number four, I'm going to go to 1976 when Rocky won. And yeah, I know Rocky has a lot of fans. And again, Rocky, it's a decent film. Got nothing against it. But it beat, not only did it beat Taxi Driver, which is a much loved movie and is a fantastic movie, it also beat Network, which I is one of my favorites. I love Network. I would definitely have picked that over Rocky. I'd have picked that over Taxi Driver, which is possibly a little controversial, but I just love Network. It's more my kind of thing. Taxi Driver's too depressing. And then for the next three, I'm going to go more recent, really. The top three are all more recent ones. I think the more recent ones scar me more, whereas there were some older ones I was going to pick, some like 30s and 40s ones, but I quite often didn't know the other nominees as well. So the top three are quite modern. So number three, well, modern to my mind. So I'm going to go to 1996, which I guess isn't that modern anymore, is in my mind. Yeah, 1996, The English Patient won, which is, it's a solidly made kind of romantic kind of drama. It looks nice, but it was no way near as good as two films which could have easily won, and that is Fargo and Secrets and Lies, which are both brilliant films, far better than The English Patient.
Which one do you think? You got to choose one now.
Fargo is probably the personal favorite. I've seen it more often.
Okay,
but I've only seen Secrets and Lies once, but I thought it was incredible. But I think Fargo probably is more of a personal choice.
Okay.
And then number two is another dual one. In fact, all my top three are dual ones. That's why I've gone for them. And that was 2018, the Green Book one, which is just, to me, is just quite an average kind of seen it done before kind of racial drama. It's okay, but nowhere near as good as my favorites that year. And one of those is The Favourite, which I think is an incredible film. I know it's not to everyone's taste, but I love it. But the one that I probably would have picked, though, is Roma. Again, not everyone's cup of tea, but I thought Roma was just pure perfection.
Wait, so you want Roma or The Favourite on your list?
Both, but I'm going to go with Roma. I'll go with Roma then. I'll go with Roma, but I do adore The Favourite as well. I thought it was a really strong year. Green Book was the bottom of the list of nominees for me, to be honest. Number one, I kind of wanted to choose some different. I tried to be original with some of my lists, some of my choices, but I can't not put Crash, the year that Crash won, because it was a joke. There's so many good films that year. Again, there's two that I'm tossing up. I might change my mind. I was going to put Brokeback Mountain because that's just a beautiful film. But I'm actually going to change my mind and go with Good Night and Good Luck. I think it's an underrated, fantastic kind of true life sort of drama. It's a really gripping, brilliantly performed, beautifully directed film. I don't think it gets enough love. So I think definitely way better than Crash, which is as subtle as a sledgehammer.
I think any of the movies that year were better than Crash.
Yeah. So it had to be that year, really, at number one.
Yeah, no, George Clooney did a great job with Good Night, Good Luck.
Mm. Right. But yeah, there were loads of others I could have chosen. But
yeah, for sure. That's the challenge here. Yeah. Picking, you basically picked 10. That's
pretty much. Because
every year you had two more that you wanted higher, but that's fine. No problem. All right. So, David, you want to once again tell people where they can find David Brook?
Yeah, they can find my reviews of indie classic world movies and cult movies and things like that over at blueprintreview.co.uk.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. David, thank you very much for joining me this week. I had a very fun time. I hope you did too.
Yeah, I did. Anytime.
So everyone have a great weekend. I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.